So welcome to Citizens Climate University. It's a weekly webinar program of Citizens Climate Lobbies that provides CCL supporters with access to in-depth training opportunities on topics related to climate change and effective climate advocacy. We're incredibly lucky and grateful tonight to have the founder and executive director of the Environmental Voting Project, Nathaniel Stinnett, with us. Nathaniel founded the Environmental Voter Project in 2015 after over a decade of experience as a senior advisor, consultant, and trainer for political campaigns and issue advocacy nonprofits. He's been hailed by the New York Times as a visionary and dubbed by Grist Magazine as the voting guru. And Stinnett is a frequent expert speaker on cutting-edge campaign techniques that we're going to find out more about tonight, as well as the behavioral science behind getting people to vote. He's held a variety of senior leadership and campaign manager positions on the U.S. Senate, congressional, state, and mayoral campaigns, and sits on the board of advisors for MIT's Environmental Solutions Initiative. So without further ado, Nathaniel, it's an honor to have you back here. We absolutely loved your national call, and we look forward to learning more tonight. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Brett. And thank you, everybody, for joining tonight. When Brett and I chatted throughout the past week, we thought it would be a good idea for me to not repeat everything that I said on the call that we had a few weeks ago, but still go over it again, just to refresh people's memories, get it clear in their minds, and then we can have time for an extended Q&A session. So what I'm going to go through now isn't different from what I went over before, but hopefully it'll be a little bit quicker. It'll get everything that I spoke about fresh in your head. And then we can dive in with some details. And I know Brett already has some questions that were submitted. So let's get going. As I mentioned before, the Environmental Voter Project does not lobby politicians. We don't endorse particular candidates. We don't even try to persuade people to care more about climate change or the environment. All that we do is we find people who are already persuaded environmentalists but aren't voting, and then we try to get them to vote more often. And the reason we're focused on that is one of the great underlying problems of the climate movement and even the environmental movement writ large, and that is this. When you poll likely voters for any election, I know Brett is now in Lexington, Kentucky. If we polled likely voters in a Lexington mayoral election, or if we polled them for president of the United States, we'd probably still see the same thing. And that's this. When you poll likely voters and ask them to list the issues they care about most, climate change and other environmental issues are almost always towards the bottom of those polls. Now, to be clear, if you ask questions differently, you often get different answers. If you ask people what their preferences are, if they would prefer government action on climate change, well, large majorities prefer that, as I'm sure many of you know. But preferences aren't as important as priorities in politics, because politicians always need to pick and choose what they're going to spend their time and money and political capital on. And so what you see in this poll here is a real problem. Whenever we poll likely voters for any election and ask what their top priorities are, climate change and the environment are way, way down. This is why we didn't get any questions about climate change in the 2016 presidential debates. This is why President Trump didn't mention climate change in the State of the Union this year. And I might add, this is why Joe Kennedy, in the Democratic response, didn't mention climate change this year. Because Democrat or Republican, liberal or conservative, if voters don't prioritize a particular issue, it's really hard to expect politicians to care about it. And the reason is this. Whether you vote or not is public record. It's public record. And so campaigns start off by just making a very clear analysis. They say, okay, We've got limited time and limited money. Who are we going to talk to and who are we not going to talk to? And they pick up public voter records and they say, oh, I'm running for governor. I'm going to talk to the people who have a history of voting in gubernatorial elections and a really high likelihood of voting in this only election that they care about. So campaigns not only end up targeting only likely voters, of course, if they're only going to target that group, they're only going to poll that group to figure out what issues they care about. And so right now, that information that was just on that previous poll, which is not cherry-picked or unique in any way, it's the same information you'll see in any poll of likely voters, that's bad news for the environment. Because politicians only care about likely voters, they only poll them to see what their priorities are. And that information is not some state secret. Every politician knows that the people who are going to decide whether they win or lose the next election don't really prioritize climate change and other environmental issues. And that's bad news. That's bad news. But, to reiterate what I said during the monthly call a few weeks ago, we've discovered something really, really interesting at the Environmental Voter Project, and that is this. The reason so few voters prioritize environmental issues is not because too few Americans prioritize environmental issues. I'll say that again because it's important. The reason so few voters prioritize environmental issues is not because too few Americans do. There are actually tens of millions of Americans who care so deeply about climate change and the environment that they do list it as one of their top two priorities. So why aren't they showing up in those polls? Because they're not voting. They're not voting. What we've realized at the Environmental Voter Project is the environmental movement doesn't necessarily have a persuasion problem as much as we have a turnout problem. We identified 15.78 million super environmentalists who did not vote in the 2014 midterm elections. We identified 10.1 million who didn't even vote in the 2016 presidential election, an election that was decided by 77,000 votes. And to be clear, these 10.1 million, they're already registered. They're already registered to vote. They just didn't walk out their doors on election day. Let me give you a little bit of context here. We have a nice round number of registered voters in the United States right now, about 200 million registered voters. In the 2014 midterm elections, about 83 million people voted. Of those 83 million, only a little more than 4 million were what we at the Environmental Voter Project would call environmentalists or super environmentalists, which is people who listed climate change or some other environmental issue as their number one or number two priority. Think, if you're running for office and you know that only the people in those blue squares at the bottom are going to turn out on election day, do you really care about what those measly four green squares in the corner think? No. I mean, that is nothing. 4.2 million out of 83 million, we're talking about 5% of the electorate. And that's pretty much the same picture in every state. Those four green squares do not drive policy. They don't. They just don't. Picture was a little bit better in the 2016 presidential elections. We had about 136, actually more like 137 million people vote, and 10.1 million of them listed climate change and the environment as one of their top two priorities. That means there are fully another 10 million super environmentalists up there at the top. These are people who are registered to vote, but don't even bother showing up for presidential elections. At the Environmental Voter Project, we don't try to turn any of these blue squares green. We're not in the persuasion business. Changing people's minds about climate change is so important, but it's also so hard and so expensive. And oftentimes, identifying the people who are already with us, identifying those green squares up at the top, who are already persuaded environmentalists who just aren't voting, and then spending our time changing their habits, Well, I won't claim that's easy, but it's a heck of a lot easier than changing minds. And so that's what we do with the Environmental Voter Project. At its most basic, all we're doing is just trying to push those green squares into the electorate. Because we know, surprise, surprise, politicians don't really care about what non-voters think. They only care about what voters think, because voters decide whether they're going to get to keep their jobs or not. And so whenever we're able to identify non-voting environmentalists, we focus all of our efforts on pushing them into the electorate. So I'm going to very quickly, again, sort of gloss over those two sort of important things that we do, which are the first two things you see on this slide. I won't spend too much time talking about habit reinforcement, but if you have questions about that, we can discuss that in this extended Q&A. So for all intents and purposes at EVP, we really just do the first two things. We identify environmentalists who don't vote, and then we turn them into more consistent voters. We mobilize them. You know, at first, I'll just spend a little bit of time talking about this identification, and then I know that one of the pre-submitted questions asked me to dig further into this, and so I will. But very, very quickly, just so you have sort of something to hold on to when you ask more questions later on this evening, we use hundreds and sometimes thousands of publicly available data points about people. Some of them are on the voter file. Some of them are publicly available at other places. And we use that information to build what's called predictive models. I'm not going to get too deeply into this unless it's something that people are curious about in the Q&A session. But we essentially use the same tools that very sophisticated presidential and other political campaigns use to individually target these people who care so deeply about climate change and the environment that they list it as one of their top two priorities. And I can go into that in more detail if people are interested. But then, once we identify those environmentalists, isolating those who don't vote is the easiest thing in the world. You don't need to be a data scientist to do that. Because again, whether you vote or not is public information. I could go to any of your hometowns, walk into City Hall, and for a minimal copying fee, or sometimes even for free, say, hey, give me the list of the updated voter file for your town. And I'll never be able to see who you vote for. That's secret. But I can sure see whether you vote or not, and what elections you make and what elections you skip. So once we identify those super environmentalists who rarely or never vote, then We can skip all the hard stuff of politics, which is trying to change people's minds or persuade them of something, and just focus on changing their behavior, changing their habits. And we do that by canvassing, calling, texting, mailing, and sending them digital advertisements. And what's really, really interesting is the Environmental Voter Project never talks about the environment for a really good reason. It doesn't work. Now, don't get me wrong. Citizens Climate Lobby should talk about the environment. You should talk about climate change. You should use the messaging that you know works. But you're trying to do something different often. You're often trying to persuade people of the importance of climate change, whether they be policymakers or fellow citizens. If all you're trying to do is get someone who's already with us to walk out their door on election day, we've realized that talking about climate change and talking about the environment actually isn't very effective. And so if you look down at the bottom left square of this slide, you'll see a lot of our messaging just deals with peer pressure and social pressure. We let people know that their neighbors are voting. We remind people that whether they vote or not is public information. Or sometimes we simply get people way ahead of an election to promise that they're going to vote. And then we call them up right before the election or send them a letter reminding them that they made a promise. That's one thing that almost every American still has in common. No matter how much we might lie in our personal lives, we want everybody else to think that we're honest promise keepers. And so if you confront someone with the fact that they made a promise to vote, and whether or not they vote is public record, Well, that's actually a very powerful tool to change their behavior and make them actually vote. Because we all want to be seen as honest, promise-keeping people. And we never make any endorsements. Part of that is for legal compliance reasons, but also part of it is just very good behavioral science. We don't want to focus on the decision that people are going to have to make at the polls. That's actually not a really good way to convince people of the importance of walking out their door on election day. They can usually make up their mind about that stuff themselves. No, we don't want to focus on that. We want to focus on the action of walking out their door. Most people will be able to look up the information. And again, we can get into that if you're curious about it. So I'm going to push through quickly to the end so we can spend tons of time on the Q&A. You can go to our website and look up a lot of our reports. We have annual reports from the 2.5 years that we've been in existence. We submit all of our work to randomized control trials, and we're getting amazing results. Not because we're mad scientists, but simply because we've decided that we can just focus on one thing, which is not worrying about persuasion, not worrying about convincing people to vote for a particular person or a particular issue. And when you clear all that stuff off to the side, you could take advantage of this really cutting-edge, behavior-changing behavioral science, and we can get some pretty amazing results. And so we haven't invented anything at the Environmental Voter Project. We've just found things in the area of data science and the area of behavioral science and put them together for the environmental movement and environmental politics in a way that a lot of other people aren't doing. And so we're taking cutting edge stuff from other fields and bringing it together. We're in 6 states, Nevada, Colorado, Georgia, Florida, Pennsylvania, and Massachusetts. We're targeting 2.4 million super environmentalists in these states who are so unlikely to vote this year that we don't think anybody's going to talk to them. But for those of you who aren't in these 6 states, we have 1,500 volunteers around the country calling and texting into these 6 states. And what's more, as an extra almost service that we offer to people in all 50 states, if you sign a promise to vote, because remember that sort of promise-keeping technique that we use is one of our turnout messages. If you sign a promise to vote on our website and give us your name and street address so we know what elections you qualify for, we will send you free election reminders whenever you have an election, even if it's for a library trustee or dog catcher race. And that's so important for 2 reasons. One, as I'm sure all of you know, I mean, you know climate policy better than I do. I'm a political guy, not a policy guy. Local elections and state elections are enormously important. Obviously, federal stuff is important too, but city halls can save the planet. States can save the planet. It's important that we vote in every election. But the second reason is whether you vote or not is public record. And every time you vote in one of these down-ticket, sleepy little elections, it only takes 2 months for the record of you having voted to show up on public voter files. And when that happens, you become a first-class citizen. Every politician in the land starts paying attention to you because you are now part of, unfortunately, a very small select group of super voters, of people that vote on a consistent basis. And those are the only people who politicians care about. So the real reason you need to vote in every election is not necessarily because library trustees are going to decide how to fight climate change, but because you want to be in that small select group that drives policy. Because believe me, politicians go where the votes are. And that might sound cynical, but it's not. It's just arithmetic. It's just how elections work. Either politicians go where the votes are, or they don't get to be politicians anymore. They don't get elected. And so it's incumbent upon all of us who care deeply about climate change to be good voters and be a part of that small group of consistent super voters, because we're the only people who politicians care about. And nothing motivates a politician more than the prospect of winning or losing an election. Believe me, if we start flooding the polls, politicians will either respond to us or they won't get elected. And believe me, they'll respond to us because they want to get elected. So this is a big, big opportunity for all of us, not just in 2018, but in 2019 and in 2020. Because again, I want to be clear, we're not some secret election winning strategy. Talking to bad voters is not a good way to win the near term. It's not a good way to win one-off elections. We're in this for the long term. We're in the electorate changing business, not the election winning business. And so it's so important for all of us to view voting as the highest form of environmental citizenship. So that's what I've got. I tried to go through that really, really quickly again, just so you could get a refresher, or for those of you who didn't see the previous presentation, to know what we're about. And now hopefully we can go into a lot more depth. And while we go into more depth, I'm just going to have this stuff up there so that you guys can go to our site, you can sign the voter pledge, you can volunteer if you're interested, and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's just absolutely exactly the context we want in the background. And I know that we've got another 35 minutes here still. So let's jump into some lightning round questions. We'll start with the ones that emailed me earlier, and then we'll go to the chat window here, and then after that, we'll go to the phones. So first off, what are your thoughts, Nathaniel, on whether it's possible that a lot of these super environmentalists that the EVP is targeting don't actually vote because they don't feel like a candidate on either side of the ballot or anywhere on the ballot is sufficiently correct in their own environmental views or preferences?
So that's a great question. And that is absolutely an excuse that voters and non-voters give for not voting. But we've got a lot of good research that tells us it is only an excuse. It's not actually a reason for not voting. So let me explain. We actually ran a study a little bit over a year ago where we polled a whole bunch of environmentalists who always vote and a whole bunch of environmentalists who never vote. And we asked them all the same set of questions about civic engagement and voting and politics. And one of the questions we asked was, do you think that politicians prioritize the issues that you prioritize? And by and large, people who didn't vote, these were all environmentalists who didn't vote said, nope, they don't. And so whoever asked this question, you're right. A lot of non-voting environmentalists do say that. But here's the really interesting thing. The environmentalists who vote all the time and never miss an election also said, by overwhelming majorities, oh no, politicians don't prioritize the issues I care about. They're not with me. And so I don't deny that there are a lot of people who might say that, but it's pretty clear to us that that's actually not the cause for them not voting, or it's not necessarily the cause for them not voting, because there are a whole bunch of super voting environmentalists who also give that excuse. And very quickly, I want to go through a bunch of other things we learned in this survey. We asked the non-voters, are you ever able to find candidates who you can really believe in to do the right thing? And most of them said, no, we can't. But all of the super voters said, no, we can't. We asked the non-voters. Every question that we asked the non-voters, the response of the super voters was pretty much the same thing. Pretty much the same thing. And so believe me, I understand this urge to try to figure out why people aren't taking an action and use that information to get them to take the action. Believe me, I understand that urge. But what we've realized through a lot of testing and a lot of studies is that this is a black box. It's really hard to figure out why people don't take certain actions, because usually what they'll do is they'll just give you what they think is a reasonable excuse, whether or not that excuse is actually the cause of them not taking the action. So it's a great question. Unfortunately, I don't think it's actually the reason why environmentalists aren't voting. And the honest answer is, I don't know why they're not voting.
First off, this is kind of a twofer. Is there a difference between voting in person versus in mail from what your guys' data shows? And how much of our non-voting is due to some counties or cities or municipalities having a poor publicization of the actual kind of election times? Is it to do with lack of information as well?
Great, great questions. Let me just quickly answer the second one first, and then I'll move on to the first one. I'm not aware of any studies that show that a lack of publicizing election information leads to lower turnout. That doesn't mean it's not the case. It could absolutely be the case. I'm just not aware of any studies that show that. But places like the Pew Foundation and CIRCLE, C-I-R-C-L-E, out of Tufts, do studies that are like that. And so if there is a study, it would be in at a place like that. Oh, and the Brennan Center for Justice as well might have studies on that. But I'm not aware of any studies that show that. As for a difference in voting behavior between in-person voting and voting by mail, there was a lot of indirect evidence that offering vote by mail increased turnout up until recently, but it was only indirect evidence. And then last year in Colorado, they were able to run an experiment that it's really, really detailed to get into the nitty-gritty of why it was a scientifically valid experiment and actually was kind of exciting with its results. But it finally showed that, yes, vote by mail does increase turnout. It does increase turnout. And the reason it's so hard to actually have good, rigorous experiments around this is, how are you going to have a control group? Like, you can't tell half of a state, no, you're not allowed to vote by mail. I mean, it's really hard to control this stuff and have it be apples to apples. And if you're interested in reading about this, Washington Monthly, which is a great magazine that actually recently wrote a great piece about us, but Washington Monthly had a really interesting article about this experiment and Colorado's vote by mail that explained, I think, very clearly why it was a rigorous experiment and actually does show that vote by mail is a great way to increase turnout. So, because certainly in other states like Colorado, there is very, very good research showing how much voting by mail has increased turnout. Absolutely. And last fall for the St. Petersburg, Florida mayoral election, we did a lot of text message campaigns around when vote by mail ballots were available to people. And those were also very impactful. So we're right with you. We're really excited about trying to take advantage of that. And not just in Florida, take advantage of that in a lot of other states that are starting to move on this. That's a great question.
Excellent. Thanks so much. So we've got a lot of enthusiastic people here, Nathaniel, that are just loving the idea of plugging into the EVP efforts throughout the country. I guess two questions for those that are in states that don't have an active campaign for EVP right now. Is there any chance that they also can persuade the nonprofit to move to California or to move to these other states that also have a lot of non-active environmental voters? And then also, if they can't, how can they plug in and a little bit more details about still being able to volunteer for some of your active campaigns?
Great. So thank you. That's I'm very grateful that all of you would ask that question. And we'd obviously love to be in all 50 states and love to have your help. So thank you. The first step whenever we go into a state is first we want to figure out if there's a large population of non-voting environmentalists in that state. And that's important because we want to have an impact and we need to have a big denominator to have an impact. If we're only going to be mobilizing non-voting environmentalists, we need to make sure that there are a whole bunch of non-voting environmentalists in a state before we go in there. But for better or for worse, there are about 22 or 23 states that have lots of non-voting environmentalists. So chances are you're in a state where we think we should be doing work. But then, before we even contact a single voter, we need to do a lot of research. We need to rent access to a voter file, which can be anywhere from $15,000 to $25,000 per year. And then we need to poll 10 to 15,000 voters just in that state, which helps us build these big predictive models that I told you about that help us identify who these non-voting environmentalists are. And that's about another $30,000 to $35,000. So before we even contact a single voter, we're spending about $55,000 or $60,000 to get access to the voter file and then do all of this data analytics to identify all these non-voting environmentalists. Then at that point, we want to make sure that we actually have the money to then reach out to them. Now, a lot of our voter outreach is done through volunteers, but in order to text and call and canvass people, we still need to have some money. And then we like to do some digital ads and direct mail as well. So all of this is a long way of me saying, before we go into a state, we want to make sure that we'll have the money to do it right, to do it right. So I'm not expecting all of you to run to our website and, you know, sign over your millions to us. But I do just want to be honest with you that before we go into a state, we want to make sure that we can really succeed and have a big impact in that state. And that means money, just like it means money to any nonprofit. The good news is what we're doing is really cheap and efficient. We could be in all 22, 23 of those states and probably have a $6 or $7 million annual budget. It is not that expensive to just do voter turnout. And usually, unless you're talking about an enormous and expensive state, we're only spending about $250,000, $300,000 per year in a state. Now, how can people volunteer if we're not in your state or if we're not about to show up in your state because we're about to get a ton of money for it? If you sign up to volunteer on our website, you will immediately get an email back with a link to a training webinar. And we run two or three training webinars each week. And this will allow you to get trained on calling or texting these non-voting environmentalists in the six states that we've identified. And guys, it is so easy. I mean, the texting, you can sit there and watch TV and just go bam, 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 and text these voters. And our really scientifically rigorous randomized control trials show that these texts can dramatically increase turnout, just text messages and calls as well. And if you happen to live in one of those six states, we'd love to have you canvass. And so it's really, really easy to get trained up. Then you can volunteer whenever you want in the comfort of your own home or with friends. And I really encourage you to do it because we would love to have your help. And we're volunteer driven, a lot like CCL is. So thank you. Thank you for your interest in that.
The last two that we got ahead of time, one of which has to do with your thoughts, Nathaniel, on the effect of our educational system or the lack of civics within our actual kind of educational framework on voter action. And then secondly, how do you identify a little bit more in depth the non-voters who support the environment with your actual kind of identification process?
Great, great. Okay, so for the first question, I'll answer it a little bit. But then I'm going to encourage all of you to go to a really, really great resource. And I mentioned it before. It's CIRCLE, C-I-R-C-L-E. Forgive me for forgetting what that actually stands for. But they're based out of Tufts. And all they do is research youth civic engagement. And they're really, really good at it. And they do lots of scientifically rigorous studies on this. And they've done some research on this. And it is pretty clear that a lack of civics education does negatively impact voter registration. Now, it's really hard to then follow someone once they register and compare the registered voters who don't have civics educations to the registered voters who did and see how it impacts turnout. Like that's a really, really hard longitudinal experiment to run. Maybe they've run something like that, but I'm not aware of it. But I am certain that there are studies, and I believe they're circle studies, they might be from somewhere else, that does show that a lack of civics education negatively impacts a whole bunch of stuff. Obviously, it negatively impacts our ability to intelligently discern. Certainly, it negatively impacts our understanding of how government works. And yes, it also negatively impacts voter registration rates. Whether it goes a step further and negatively impacts voter turnout, I don't know. To get to the second question, I actually brought some slides because I thought we might get into this a little bit. And what I am not going to do is run out the clock on this one question and make all your eyes cross, because it can get really, really in-depth and complicated. But I do want to respect the question. It's an important, good question. So I am going to go into a little bit of detail. Big data has completely revolutionized politics. I'm sure all of you are sick and tired of hearing about big data, but it has absolutely changed politics. And whereas 14 or 18 years ago, when John Kerry or Barack Obama were first running, people talked about soccer moms and NASCAR dads. Back then, people targeted demographic groups. Now, political campaigns can target individuals. They can target individuals. And I won't expect you to read every single word on here, but very quickly, how we do it is this. We'll go into a state. We'll rent access to a voter file, and it will be a special voter file. It'll be a voter file that has lots of privacy controls in place, but has a lot of behavioral and consumer data points appended to each person's record. Now, I want to be very clear about something. At the Environmental Voter Project, we use the same data that a lot of other progressive groups or political campaigns or the Democratic National Committee, even though we're nonpartisan, the same data that the DNC has. We do not use stolen data like Cambridge Analytica did or anything like that. We adhere to the highest ethical standards. But we do use some of this data that is out there, like what magazines people subscribe to and things like that, to help identify these environmentalists. And the way we do it is like this. We will poll 10, 20,000 people in a state, and we'll just ask them two questions. We'll say, hey, what's your number one most important political priority? What's your number two most important political priority? And let's say out of 20,000 people, 1 or 2,000 list climate change or some other environmental issue. Well, then, it's the easiest thing in the world for data scientists to start looking for the hidden patterns and correlations. They might be able to say, and please, like, don't take this data you're seeing as being like the God's honest truth in every single state across the nation. This is just in one particular state. They'll say, oh, wow, look, agricultural and forestry employees are 11 times more likely than the average to list some environmental issue as a top two priority. Oh, and look, if you're Catholic, you're 5 times more likely. And if you care about gun control, you're 3 times more likely. And if you have a cell phone and ditched your landline, you're 9 times more likely. And usually by itself, these data points don't mean anything. But if you combine them, and you say, oh, wow, if you bought a Volvo between 10 and 12 years ago, just moved to Lexington, Kentucky, are a Citizens Climate Lobby member, have 2 kids and shop at Abercrombie and Fitch, then you have a really high likelihood of caring about climate change. You know, they can find these hidden patterns and correlations. And then what data scientists do is they build a predictive model, which is kind of like what it sounds like. It's a model that helps you predict how likely every person is on that voter file to list climate change and the environment as one of their top two priorities. And this is a distribution chart of one of our states. I think this might be Florida, showing you, hey, look, there are almost 450,000 people who only have a 10% likelihood of fitting our criteria of being super environmentalists. And I think the average score is something like an 18 or 19. But then there are a whole bunch of people, hundreds of thousands, over a million even, who are three times more likely than the average voter to list climate change or the environment as one of their top priorities. And so we test and retest these scores that we append to each record in the voter file until we're really confident they're accurate. And I'll tell you, at the very end of this process, we ship out our list to an outside polling firm, and we say, we think we have isolated a whole bunch of super environmentalists here. Can you call a random sample of them and just ask off the top of their head what their top two political priorities are? And the worst score we've ever gotten on that test is that 89% of the respondents off the top of their head offer that climate change or the environment is one of their top two priorities. That's the worst score we've ever gotten. So this stuff is frighteningly accurate. And just to offer an analogy here, I don't want to talk about this too long, but it's a good question. This might sound really like complicated. It's actually pretty much the same thing that insurance companies have been doing for years. My guess is many of the people on the call here have bought life insurance before. And when you do that, you need to give them a lot of data about yourself. You tell them your medical history, your age, how much you exercise, how much you drink, how much you smoke. And they take all that information and they compare it to the same data from millions of other people. And not to get morbid, but they need to predict how long you're going to live. And if they're off even by a little bit, they lose billions of dollars. Now, they don't call it predictive models. They call it actuarial tables, but they're very, very similar. And so we're doing the same thing. We're polling tens of thousands of people per state, cross-referencing the information with a lot of data, and building these actuarial tables, building these models that help us zero in on the super environmentalists. And then it's the easiest thing in the world to cut out the ones who don't vote, because remember, that's public information.
Great. I didn't know we should have put actuarial in your bio. Thank you for the background on that. I'm going to actually try to roll in three questions that are all kind of come up in the chat window. If you even wanted to go back to that little camel hump.
Okay. We'll go back to the camel hump.
So one of which is, what's up with that dip at the 20 score range?
Yep.
Secondly, is there more consistent national data as far as, is there certain categories of demographics that are more likely to be non-voting environmental voters, like age groups, you know, or particular states? And then connected to that, is there an actual trend with youth or other forms of mobile voters that, you know, tend to relocate often and haven't registered as also qualifying for being some of those non-voters?
Right. So this sort of camel hump distribution is actually something that we see in pretty much every state. There is a large number of people who have a very low likelihood of caring about climate change and the environment. And then you have a dip that usually is where the average voter lies. And sometimes that's at 20%, sometimes it's closer to 40%. There are some states where the average voter has a 40% likelihood of deeply caring about climate change and the environment. But usually we'll see something like this distribution here, where then there's a much more gradual hump. And sometimes it's closer to the right, sometimes it's further to the left, depending on the state. But this is a popular distribution. It's a popular distribution. To get to the other questions, before I answer the demographic question, let me just give you a caveat by saying behavioral and consumer data is always more helpful to us in identifying environmentalists than demographic data. By which I mean, if we know you just bought an electric vehicle, or if we know you subscribe to National Geographic, or that you ditched your landline and only use a cell phone and always buy Apple products, you know, like stuff like that is so much more valuable than knowing your age or your gender. It just is. It has so much more predictive power. That being said, to get to those second and third questions that were asked, yes, younger people tend to care more about climate change and the environment than older people do. But it's not as clear-cut as you might think. Now, to be clear, at the Environmental Voter Project, remember, we have a very sort of idiosyncratic and high bar for how we identify environmentalists. We're trying to identify people who list climate change or other environmental issues as their number one or number two priority. But those people, there are actually more of those people as a percentage of the denominator in the 25 to 34 year old age group than in the 18 to 24 age group. So I'll say that again. 18 to 24 year olds are not as likely to list climate and the environment as a top two priority as 25 to 34 year olds. Then we see it dip down again. But then what's interesting is we see the distribution start to come up again with people in their late 60s all the way through their 70s, especially among women. We are like jokingly referring to it as the grandmother effect. We don't know if that's what it is, but we're certainly seeing that there is this significant group of women in their early, mid, late 60s, even early 70s who are now really starting to prioritize this. Other demographic trends we're seeing. Latinos, African Americans, and to a lesser extent, Asian Americans, across the board in every state, care more deeply about climate change than Caucasians do. And in some states, it's an enormous disparity. In Florida, African Americans are twice as likely to list climate change as a top priority than Caucasians are. And there's a lot of good Pew research, PEW, the Pew Research Center, a lot of good Pew research showing that, well, of course, African Americans and Latinos tend to care more about this issue. They are living in the areas where they're feeling the greatest impacts of climate change. And so that's probably why we're seeing that. And finally, one other sort of demographic trend that we're seeing is lower income Americans are starting to be far more likely to care about climate change and the environment than higher income Americans. And so this, you know, everything that I've just spoken about in the last 3 or 4 minutes really flips the typical stereotype of an environmentalist on its head. But it's absolutely true. And we see it in our research. We see it in the research by the Yale Program on Climate Change Communications and in Pew Research Center research. Your typical environmentalist is no longer a white yuppie or a hipster living in Brooklyn or Portland. It's far more likely to be a Latina grandmother in Phoenix.
These are super helpful. How did you identify the 6 states that you've chosen to have campaigns, if it is somewhat different than the funding explanation you gave earlier? And then second to that, what do you say in these text messages? If we're going to hit a bunch of texts, you know, what is kind of the normative phrase that is convincing people to get active? And does that connect back to these phrases that were taught within CCL to connect climate to the economic impacts or national security or health framing? You know, I'm guessing that that isn't connected, but is there some kind of frame that we can learn from in our own messaging?
So great question. So we launched in Massachusetts 2.5 years ago, and we did that for a few reasons. One, I live here. But two, we had reason to believe there were a whole bunch of non-voting environmentalists in Massachusetts, and we were right. And then three, there were a whole lot of elections from November of 2015 to November of 2016. And during our first year, we needed to have a lot of elections, because the only way to turn a non-voter into a voter is to have an election. And we wanted to be able to test all of our tools to see if this was actually going to be a success. So that's why we started in Massachusetts. Then last year, we expanded into Georgia in the spring, and then Pennsylvania, Florida, Colorado, and Nevada in the fall. And the reason we did that was twofold. One, there are enormous numbers of non-voting environmentalists in those states. Enormous numbers. And as I mentioned before, we have to go to target-rich environments. If we go to a state where there aren't any non-voting environmentalists, we could hit a home run every time there was an election and it still wouldn't make a difference because the denominator isn't big enough. The second reason we went to those states was we also were able to raise a lot of money to go into those states. Not necessarily from those states, but people were excited. When we showed them the states that had lots of non-voting environmentalists, they said, oh yeah, we really like these ones. So it was a combination of the research showed us they were target-rich environments and we were able to get the funding for it. To get to the second question, when we text these voters, what's the messaging that we're using? It's very simple. It's pretty much entrapment. I make it sound worse than it actually is, but it's entrapment. You're simply saying, hi, this is Nathaniel. I'm a volunteer from the Environmental Voter Project. We're a nonpartisan nonprofit encouraging people to vote. You have an election for blah coming up on blah. Can we count on you to vote? Now, we know merely the fact that you are texting this person means we know that they are an awful voter. But what you're trying to do is you're trying to get them to say, oh, yeah, yeah, I'm going to vote. And if they say that, then you want to take it a step further. Sometimes you say, oh, well, will you make a promise to vote in every election? If you do, we'll send you free election reminders every time there's an election. And some people take that extra step. Sometimes they don't. But essentially what you're doing is you're trying to simply get someone to say that they're going to vote. And I know that sounds so banal and simple, but it works. Because then, in the lead up to election day, we follow up with them and we say, hey, Brett, just as a reminder, back on June 21st, you made a promise that you were going to vote in the election on Tuesday. And we know it's really important to you to follow through on your promises. And so Tuesday's your opportunity to follow through on that promise. That's all. That's all. And it sounds very simple, but it's actually born out of really good behavioral science. Because being good, honest promise keepers is a societal norm that we all buy into. Regardless of how honest we are in our daily lives, we all want everybody else to think that we're really honest. That's a societal norm that we all buy into. And so when we try to hold people to their previous promises, and sometimes when we even let them know that whether they actually follow through on it is public record, well, that sends turnout through the roof. So that's the simple messaging that our volunteers use. And finally, no, we don't tie it to economic issues. We don't even talk about climate change. But I want to be clear. I'm not saying that the messaging you use at CCL isn't good messaging. It's very good messaging. You just often have a different goal. Your goal is often to persuade people to care about climate change or persuade policymakers to care about climate change. And that's very different. Persuasion messaging is very different from turnout messaging. And there's a lot of good research showing that that messaging that you're using is good for your purposes. It's just not good for our purposes.
Thank you so much, Nathaniel. Two last things that have come here, Nathaniel. I know we're at the top of the hour here, but do you have a next six states from your organization's perspective for Target Rich Get Out the Vote operations? And is there an app for that? Do you have an app in development for EVP?
Ah, I see. So let me answer the second question first. The texting and calling that we do is done through an app. Now, it is not the Environmental Voter Project's app. We use, for texting, we use an organization called Hustle. Maybe many of you have used it before. I know a lot of progressive campaigns use Hustle before, but it's a very easy app where you can just download the people you're supposed to text. We have all of the scripts loaded in there. You never even need to think. You just sort of press buttons and send text messages. And we also have a very easy thing for calling as well. There isn't really a reason for us to design our own app just because these other vendors have already done it and it's really easy for us to just sync into what they're doing. As for the next six states, so we're already in six states. As I mentioned, we have about 23 total that we think it would really work in. So we've got another 17 that we think at the current moment makes sense for us to expand into. I'll be totally honest. We will never, ever, ever let funders push us into a state that doesn't make sense. But of those 17 states that make sense, if someone really cares about Arizona more than New Mexico, and both of them are on our target list, we're going to Arizona. Like, I'll be very clear about that. Like, we've found 17 states that make a whole lot of sense for us, a whole lot of sense. And if it's easier to raise money to go into one of those states than it is for the other, well, we'll pay attention to that. But, and excuse me while I just sort of look off camera here a little bit and look at my sort of handy dandy map here. If you go on to our website, you'll be able to see in the reports and studies drop-down menu our 2017 annual report. And in that annual report on page 4, you'll see a map of the United States where each state is colored in. And you'll be able to see, it's essentially a density map that shows you which states have the highest concentration of non-voting environmentalists as a percentage of overall turnout. And that will give you a pretty good guide as to the states where we think we can find target-rich environments. So states that make a whole lot of sense to us. But we'll never let a donor push us into states that don't make sense. But if we're able to get a lot of people excited about us working in one of those states where there are a lot of non-voting environmentalists, awesome. We'll do it.
Excellent. It looks like you won't be going into the northern, western Midwest anytime soon then. We'll have to wait for that effort beyond the 2018 campaign.
Yeah.
So without further ado, I know that we're at the end of the hour. I want to be mindful of your time, Nathaniel. If people had any questions that they didn't have a chance to ask, I know that we've gotten through all the ones that were submitted. Please email me. So it's just brett@citizensclimate.org. I just want to close by thanking everyone for being on the line tonight, for submitting such wonderful questions, and to also just emphasize that I think that the mutual admiration that CCL has for your efforts with Environmental Voter Project are deeply appreciated, Nathaniel. I know that on your website, you also advertise for filling an essential niche in the environmental movement. We like to think about that whole climate space as an ecosystem where all of these nonprofits have their own focus as well. And so we definitely have a lot of admiration for your efforts. We know that a lot of our volunteers are very interested in helping out, not only in these six states, but throughout the country. And we really look forward to continuing to work together. So thank you again for your time tonight and giving another hour of your evening for all of our benefit, Nathaniel.
Well, it's my pleasure. I have an enormous amount of admiration for everybody on this call and the entire organization. You guys are the best.
Well, back at you. Have a wonderful week, everyone, and we'll look forward to seeing you soon. CCU is going to be on a summer break for a month, but we'll resume in mid-July, and we wish you well in the meantime. Thanks, everyone.